you know, good morning, people. I got a bit of a cold. Got into a cold place last night for 10 minutes, and it's thrown my fucking breathing out to the shit. Yeah, for many, many years, I've got a few health issues, you know. And for many, many years, I wouldn't take huge amounts of exertion, and I would be just so fucked. You know, if the house was on fire, I'd lie in bed and just let the house burn. You know, just too fucked to get out of bed type, exhausted sort of stuff. And one of the things, I am a realist, is that sometimes I contemplate, you know, the quality of life. You know, that there is a point where you can be sort of, you know, a bit mangled, a bit damaged, all these other sorts of issues, and still be okay. But there comes a point where, you know, you just think, I think there will come a point where you just, where I'll just go, you know, things have deteriorated so badly and to a point that I really don't want to go on like this, you know. And this is not sort of rampant sort of suicidal type shit. This is just saying, you know, I'd just rather just take a nice big overdose and go quietly off to sleep and just never wake up. And that's kind of, you know, the idea of having a nice long sleep forever kind of, you know, has a certain amount of appeal to it, you know. So what I did is I wasn't going, oh my God, I can't cope. I was just climbing into bed and I was so fucked. And, you know, I have all these recordings of all these people, what I call in recovery, you know, people in AA and NA and all these other 12-step fellowships and that, and you know, therapists and stuff, and a lot of it's really good, you know. But sometimes I'd just like to have someone to talk to, you know, like late at night or 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever. And yeah, I got talked. I just rang offline just for a chat. You know what I mean? Just to sort of, you know, just to sort of say, well, you know, there may come a time. You know, because I was pretty fucked. I wasn't in pain. I wasn't suffering. I wasn't sort of, you know, hallucinating demons or anything. I was just fucked. I was just really, really fucking exhausted. And I was climbing into bed and thinking, God, you know, this is a bit too much some days. You know, not as in like, oh my God, no, but you know, you know, I just thought, you know, I just tired, just worn out, tired, you know. And I thought, well, you know, so I just wanted to talk about these things. I didn't want to go and kill myself. I just wanted to talk about that there is an issue between irrational sort of suicide based upon sort of dramas, and then there's making choices about one's quality of life, and that there may in fact be a definite cut-off point where you just say, this is, I've had enough, you know, I'm not going on like this, this is crap, you know. I'd rather a nice quick clean kill and, you know, end of issue, you know. So yeah, this is I talked to this fucking, you know, that's I think worthy of discussion, because I think end of life choices are important things, you know. You know, medically assisted suicides, all that sort of stuff, you know, just nice warm bed, nice location, you know, fresh air, you know, and a nice quiet overdose, you know. It's good, you know. You know, but that's, I think, you know, and yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to discuss this, just to sort of saying, well, you know, wanted to connect with another person and just to talk about these issues. And what I got was this fucking another lifeline. 5% of people are really fucking good. They're on the ball, they're sane, they're fast on their feet, they can navigate their way through conversations. The next 5% are passable, and the next, you know, 5%, they're okay. You know, they're not really good, but they'll do, you know. But the next 85% are a mixture of just fucking head cases, lunatics, head cases, neurotics, just fucked in the head people who shouldn't be doing that. And so this is I'm going to post this because this is a really good conversation. And then to follow it on, I just thought this woman, I thought, what are you fucking even doing here? You know, and I said that to her. Well, you can't talk to me like, oh, well, I can and I have, so fuck off, you know. That's uplifting. my mental health has just suddenly improved. And then I just thought, oh, fuck this, you know. So I cranked on this AA recording of this woman. And, you know, and I just thought, fuck, you know, people who are into owning their own issues and dealing with them really have a lot to go for them. And all these cunts that sit around having opinions and fucking know-it-all, no-fuck-all syndrome and have the, yeah, and they have the know-it-all, no-fuck-all syndrome, you know. You know, this is what you get with Lifeline. You know, a lot of... You know, this is... You know, people who are so fucked in the head they couldn't bloody, you know... Oh, God, you know. So, anyway. Yeah, so, anyway, so this is those three parts in this recording. The introduction, the fucking Lifeline phone call, and the fucking idiot in that, you know. And then moving on to the AA recording, which is... You know, you turn it on, you go, oh, fuck, this feels sane. This feels responsible. This feels grounded, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's not the same as having someone to talk to, but it's not fucking bad either, you know? So, yeah, kudos to people in AA and other fellowships and that are really into owning their own shit and dealing with it. And, yeah, I hope you enjoy it. Bye.
Lifeline can support you. Hello, this is Lifeline. When we help you?
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. How can I help you?
I found that when I just got to get comfy. That when I thought I was going to be on hold for like an hour or something, you know.
So you weren't prepared, is that right?
Well, I kind of, sort of am, but I'm kind of, sort of, you know, not. I was just putting my dry cat food into the cat feeder because the cats need food, and if they don't get food then they try to eat my face when I'm in bed at night, but it usually takes them a week to get round to doing that. Yeah, so...
Have you got the cat fed?
Yeah, got fresh water. Got fresh food. And, yeah, I'm not feeling super good, actually.
You're not feeling super good? What's going on?
Just getting old and a few issues, you know?
That sounds tough.
Not really. It's just a good, you know, because I think people sort of overreact that sometimes you get old and you're thinking, you know, the quality of life, and you think, oh, God, I'd just rather just lie down and die, you know. It's too hard to get up and do it one more day.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Hey?
Have you had thoughts of suicide?
Oh, don't be so fucking pedantic. That's the end of life type choices, you know. Do I go on till I'm absolutely fucked, or do I just say, well, I've had enough?
Well, you have called.
Oh, shut up! You should be, buddy. You shouldn't even be on this service because you're so fucking dim. Piss off. You fucking moron. I can. Now, fuck off.
Speaker for tonight, Leslie C. San Rafael.
Good evening. My name is Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Steps to Freedom group, which meets on Monday nights in San Rafael. And I'd like to begin by welcoming the new people tonight, or if you're here back again, or if you're struggling, I sympathize with you, because I have been there, and I have done that. In fact, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to stop drinking. Permanent sobriety was not part of my agenda. I just wanted to get the monkey off my back. You know, I wanted to tell people who were so adamant that I had to do something about my problem, that I was doing something about my problem. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that the morning that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was it really wasn't any different than any other morning had been for a long time. It's just that I really think that God granted me a window of sanity through which I looked at my life as it really was, and not as I rationalized it or imagined it or dreamed it could be or felt like I was going to be rescued someday from it, but as it really was. And I was a 28-year-old maintenance drinker. I lived in a shack behind a bar called Red's Recovery Room. First time I ever spoke out of town, I said to my sponsor, how will I describe Red? She said, just give them the name. They'll understand. Really, my life was over. I was done. I was finished. And I don't think until that morning I realized that I was done. And I was down to two options. And they were commit suicide or go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I gotta tell you that, you know, it's just that suicide seems so permanent, you know, sort of like a permanent option that, you know, you couldn't reverse or change it. And not only that, but I could not figure out how to kill myself. And I really want to tell you about that because I think it's interesting that I sort of went through all these machinations about killing myself when the option of going to Alcoholics Anonymous was there, and I was not willing to really consider that until I was down to what I thought was only one option. I had had an uncle put a gun in his mouth and blow his brains out, and that was a real mess, physically I'm talking about mess, in the bathroom of his home for the rest of the family to clean up. And I had sort of been a mess for a while for my family, and the thought of having to have them clean up one more mess was sort of beyond me. Well, not only that, but I didn't have a gun, or else I would have been in jail for murder. So it was good that that was not a possibility. And I know there are some of you in here who have done this slice your wrist open thing. What is that about? That looks painful. And you have to sit there and bleed out. No, I'm sorry. I drank for that kind of pain. You know, I don't inflict that on myself in any real knowing way, consciously anyway. So that was out of the question. I suppose I could have done it with pills. Well, that would have been out of the question as well. First of all, you had to get enough pills together. And I was a person who recreated, you know, with those kind of pills. I would have thought, well, I don't really have enough, so I'll just take two. And, you know, a couple more, and, you know, it would have taken a long time to get that many all at once, so that was out of the question. I had given up driving, And I was a blackout drinker, and I came to one morning and found the car still running. Now, I don't know if I just sort of got out there and started it up and got bored and wandered away, or whether I actually drove somewhere, but I guess I missed that, you know, thing. And I don't ever remember consciously thinking, my God, Leslie, you have to quit drinking. I said, my God, Leslie, you have to quit driving. And I did. I sold the car, drank up the proceeds, so I have no car. And the only way I can really think to commit suicide, that only takes sort of a burst of intention, and then, you know, then the decision is pretty much out of your hands, was to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, which was 45 miles south of where I was considering suicide. And so I knew I was going to have to make polite conversation with somebody who was going to pick me up hitchhiking, going to, and I could not fathom what you would say in polite conversation to a person when you were going to kill yourself on the bridge. So I was so sick that morning, it just seemed like a lot of effort. And I thought, no, I can't do it. So I sort of came back to that AA option. Now, I want to tell you that I had never met anybody who had ever gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody said to me, Leslie, your friends died. They didn't get sober. And that's really true. When I was about 21 years old, there were 8 of us who ran together, and by the time I got sober at 28, I was the only one still alive. So, I mean, that was true. You know, people died around me a lot. They don't now, by the way, just in case you're wondering. Once in a while, but not too frequently. At any rate, I had never met anybody who had gone to AA. I'd never met anybody who got sober and went back out or anything like that. And I didn't know much about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I knew something about being alcoholic. I knew I wasn't alcoholic. I missed that sort of category designation, I'm not sure. But I knew I wasn't alcoholic because what alcoholics were little old men in trench coats who carried a bottle in a paper bag, and they hung out somewhere around 3rd and Townsend in the city, and they slept in doorways. That was an alcoholic. Not a woman, 28 years old, who couldn't even keep a job, living behind a bar, drinking 24 hours a day in Katati. No, couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. So the fact of going to Alcoholics Anonymous was sort of an exercise just to sort of make everyone around me feel better and get them off my back. So I went into the bar, and I used the bar phone, and I called the AA hotline there in Sonoma County. And in those days, the hotline was manned by an answering service where a lot of recovering alcoholics worked, but I don't know if the woman that I talked to that morning was alcoholic or not, because I said the same thing that most alcoholics not in recovery say. I said, I never, ever, 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 ever want to drink again. No sincerity at all, by the way. And she said, well, let me put you in touch with people who feel the same way you feel, which was sort of interesting because I'm sure she knew that I was not sincere. But she was sending me off to AA anyway, and she gave me the address and the time for the meeting that evening. And I spent the rest of the day getting dressed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just didn't want you people to know how pitiful I was. The book describes it as pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And that's how I felt. I just was at the bottom. I felt like, you people describe it as a soul sickness, and that's exactly how I felt. And I felt like there were no options, there was no place to go, there was nothing to do, and I could not imagine not drinking. Couldn't. In fact, as amazing as this sounds to me today, I had these living problems, and then I had this drinking thing, and I never married them. I never put them together. They weren't part of the same issue at all. Anyway, I was in Hawaii one year for the Hawaii conference, and there was a woman who spoke. She was very funny, and she was a Beverly Hills socialite. And she described getting dressed for the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. She wanted to be appropriately attired. And so she was, you know, everything in the closet, on, off, nothing. She couldn't decide what was appropriate attire, and she couldn't call anyone. She couldn't call a friend and say, hey, listen, I'm going off to AA. What do you think I ought to wear? And so she was sort of stuck. And she finally decided on a basic black sheath dress and pearls. And I just imagined her like swooping into one of our meetings, you know, like that, like we wouldn't go, no. But that's the way I felt. You know, I just wanted to be appropriate. I wanted to look good. I didn't want you people to think that I was such a deadbeat. You know, I had always been disappointing. My mother and father are not alcoholic, and they're very much self-made people. They come from real abject poverty out of the Depression, into Stanford on a full scholarship. I mean, I can't even imagine what that takes. And I was always the person of potential, which was always followed by, it's too bad, you know? I mean, I was like, you know, she's so bright. She has such potential. It's too bad. You know, always, and I know that my folks for years looked at me and thought, what is wrong with this girl? And I sort of felt the same way. You know, I just didn't want you people to know what a loser I was. And for that brief moment in that day, I felt more a loser than I had ever felt before. Thank God. And thank God I had given up driving, and thank God the bridge was a long way away. Because I would never have ended up here. I would have ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I really believe that God, in what I think was his infinite wisdom, had decided that I'd had enough and sent me off to Alcoholics Anonymous to you people, because I was really a mess. So I showered. That's when I realized not only had I given up driving, but apparently bathing had become a lot of effort as well. And I was, my creases in my wrists were white and everything else was sort of brown. I sort of, you know, decided that that was a lot of effort. So I got into the, well, it's dangerous for an alcoholic of my type because, you know, being drunk all the time, well, it's slippery, you know, it's wet. Just not, you know. It's a lot of effort. So I sort of went through a lot of effort that day, and I think I attempted cosmetics. I know exactly what I wore. I wore this two-piece dress thing from another lifetime, you know, trying to look as though I were, because I was down to the point where it wasn't that I couldn't get a job, I could not keep one. You know, it wasn't that I couldn't get a friend, I couldn't keep one. It wasn't that I couldn't get a man in my life, I couldn't keep one. The last man I had, he said to me, you know what, you're a real nice lady when you don't drink. The problem is, you don't ever not drink anymore. And that's sort of the way my life was. My family had asked me not to come around anymore. I thought they were jerks. I thought they were mean, cruel. I didn't realize that watching me kill myself one organ at a time was painful. It was a problem. It was something that was painful for them to do. So they asked me not to come around. And so I got all gussied up to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous so you people wouldn't know how bad off things were. And I hoofed it, of course, having no car. That got increasingly aggravating the longer I did not drink, by the way, that whole car thing. But I hoofed it over to the meeting. It was in a grammar school, an old grammar school that had been converted to a, like a community center. There was no sign for Alcoholics Anonymous, which I found really annoying. By this time, I haven't had a drink all day. You can imagine what kind of, you know, state I was in. And my tolerance level, let's just tell you, was really, really, really low. And so I sort of went looking for this meeting. Long hallway, rooms down each side. First room was Tai Chi. Got that, you know, right off the bat. The second room, I'm pretty sure now, must have been like jazzercise or something. And I looked in there and I thought, geez, I hope that's not Alcoholics Anonymous, because it really looked like a lot of effort, especially in the condition I was in. And then I walked by, first room on this side looked like it was a PTA meeting, sort of ready to start. I kept walking, and this woman shot out of that room, and she said, "Are you looking for Alcoholics Anonymous?" I thought, how can she tell? Well, there are some of you who know my story, but let me just tell you that at 50 paces, there was no question I belonged here. You see, I only had one leg in the pantyhose. Okay? So the other one was sort of drifting along behind me. When I tell you now that I attempted cosmetics, you see the full impact of that statement. Person can't even get into their stockings. The whole eyeliner thing might be really suspect. I just want to show you. Thanks to God, I'm telling you. And I really don't know how I had done that. I must have put my foot through it. Because I've tried just, you know, pulling it up only halfway, and it's painful. So I must have put my foot through it, not realizing it, which just goes to my condition. And the other leg was drifting and probably had caught several times, so it was like growing longer by the moment. Well, anyway, the people that were there generously share with me when they think maybe I might be taking too much credit for my own sobriety, the way that I actually managed my life when I was doing it totally. So there I was with one leg in the pantyhose and God knows what on my face, and God knows, I mean, you can just imagine, if you can't even get that thing going, the rest of you is probably sort of in the same structure. And yet you people welcomed me, got me into the room, I think got me a cup of coffee, maybe just handed me a cup, I'm not sure. I'm sure I was shaking by that time because I hadn't had a drink. I don't know why. I was not a person who deprived myself of much, and it's certainly not a drink at any time. So for me not to have had a drink that day was unusual. And the only thing I can think of is that God really had decided that maybe I'd had enough and made that choice easy for me. And something happened in that meeting that happens in every single AA meeting, no matter where it is in the world that I've ever been to. And that is about 10 minutes before the meeting actually starts, we get so loud. Have you ever noticed this? Have you ever just sat with your eyes closed and listened? Life happens here. You know, we're talking about doing stuff and going places and our successes and our failures. And we're talking about families and friends and work. And it just gets louder and louder and louder. And by the time the chairperson or the secretary or the bell ringer rings or yells, and half the time people whistle and, you know, dim lights, and I mean, we're like really hard to get in our seats because life is happening here. And I was jealous of that. I was really jealous of that. See, nothing was going on in my life at all. Nothing. In fact, I heard somebody talk about vacation plans. See, if you were to ask me that moment, did I want to do something? I might be able to make that decision, but to plan something and actually execute it beyond my capacity by that time. And I was so jealous. I like to say envious because it sort of sounds better, but the reality is I was really jealous. And you guys looked So you looked really lame. I have to tell you that. Really, really lame. But you looked happy. And I thought, wow, this is sort of it. Woman came in, where I got sober, if it was your birthday, you brought your own cake. And she walked in, and she had a cake. She set it down, and said, wow, is it your birthday? And she said, yes. They said, how old are you? And I thought, wow, how rude. Never ask a woman her age. And she was sort of that age where I thought she might be a little sensitive to it, you know. And I thought, wow, you know. And she said, 5. Well, even in my stupor, you know, I couldn't get my leg in the pantyhose, but this woman was really over 5. And it suddenly occurred to me that she had been 5 years without a drink. And I was like, couldn't imagine. You know, this was in July, and you know what I was thinking. What do you do at Christmas? 6 months later, hadn't even come. What do you do at New Year's? What do you eat with pizza? I mean, how do you watch a ball? And I was serious. You know, I know this is all funny to us now, but I was like, serious. How do you toast at a wedding? Now, I want you to know that no one had asked for a long time, so I was not in jeopardy of having to do this toasting thing anytime soon. But just in case, what do you do at a wedding? How do you live without having without taking a drink, without alcohol? And about that time, the meeting started, and they read that portion of chapter 5 that we read here tonight. And it starts out with, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I looked around at you people, and you didn't look like amazing wizards or anything like that. You looked pretty common to me. And I thought, wow, you know, maybe if these people can do this, maybe I can do this too. And the thing that amazed me was, that when you opened your mouth and you talked, I was nodding. I understood what you were saying. And that was the very first time I can remember ever in my whole life not feeling like a Martian. I heard a woman one day said that she walked into the rooms of AA and found the rest of the Martians, and that's exactly how I felt, you know. You people were talking, and for the very first time you talked Leslie's language. You knew what I was doing, what was going on with me. And the only thing that bothered me, I have to tell you, was the worse your story was, the more everyone laughed. And it was just, I thought it was quite heartless of you. I didn't realize that laughter is so healing for us, that we laugh at ourselves and we laugh at each other as we're laughing at ourselves, because we're just so amazing out there. And quite frankly, in here too, of most of the time. But I remember going home from that meeting, and I was, for the very first time, I had a small drop of something I had never really had before, and that was hope. Before then, I had existed, I had tolerated, I had lived through, I had survived, but I had never really hoped it could be different. Now, I would like to tell you that what I did was went to a lot of meetings, got a big book, read it, got a sponsor, worked the steps, got a God in my life, and, you know, here you have it. Well, here you have it, but that's not what I did. I am truly a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. But all I really did was I went to a lot of meetings. Because I was not employable, I had nothing but time to go to meetings. So I just went to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, because it was the only place I felt comfortable in my own skin. It was the only place that I felt that hope that you people constantly talked about, because the miracle of your recovery was substantial to me. I could feel it. I could see it. And when you talked about what life had been like before, and I looked at you now, I could see the difference. I could feel the difference. And I thought you were sincere. It never occurred to me you might be telling lies. It never occurred to me you might be fabricating. Never. And I was just, I wanted to hear your miracle. And I felt better in meetings when I was there, so that's right, I went. Oh, and I did buy a big book. No one said to me, are you reading it? People said, do you have a big book? So I took to carrying it. So you didn't have to ask. Okay. Now, I don't know about you, but the very first time I opened this book and began to read, I thought, who wrote this? Ooh. First of all, it was archaic. It was definitely male. It was definitely Christian. And I thought, well, isn't that quaint? We'll just go to meetings. And when I looked at these steps on the wall, I thought, you have got to be kidding. Now, I could see one because obviously I was powerless. There was no question about it. But what's this five thing? Now, I could even maybe do four, but five, another person, not on your life. And beyond that, there was this nine. Now, why did I have to apologize to the people who made my life miserable? Don't be ridiculous. So I practiced one, and that part of 12, which is carry the message. I was incredible at carrying the message. Everyone I knew who even at any time in their life had put alcohol to their lips, alcoholic or not, got the story. I was a champ at it. I don't think anyone ever got sober, but I did. So I just kept going to meetings. And there was this, you can sort of imagine, it's sort of a small town. And there was this big room, and it had this big table in the middle of it. And it had pews that had come out of an old church all along the sides. And this woman, there weren't a lot of women in the fellowship in that community, but this woman, she sat on one side of the room and she knitted during meetings, and she was cool and she was very mean, and I had her number. And I didn't want anything to do with her. And so I began to run. Now, I really put myself in a lot of jeopardy. I swear to you, the higher power must have looked down and thought, oh my God, from the frying pan to the fire. Because I began to run with the men in the group who would allow a brand new woman to run with them, which I consider a pretty Jeopardy type situation. But, you know, God was benevolent, and I did not have to drink, and I did not have to get too crunched. And so I ran around with the men, didn't want anything to do with your women, thank you. And especially this woman, she's very mean. She used to talk about slipping stuff, and she would look right at me. And I wanted nothing to, so I kept her in my peripheral vision at all times, before and after me. That table was between that woman and me. You know, we did this dance in the hall. And, you know, God forbid I should meet her on the stairway up or down. It was, you know, I got very busy very quickly when she was around. And if she was really at the meeting, I left right after the meeting because there was no sense in staying. She was sort of this sentinel, and she sort of watched the behavior. And one day she walked up to me. I almost peed my pants, I have to tell you. I was very frightened. And she said, do you have a sponsor? Well, I hadn't breathed a truthful word in years, but I said no. I don't know why. It's another act of God, I'm sure. And she said, I'm your sponsor. Here's my phone number. Go home and call me. And I did. I was too frightened not to. I just went right. And I called her because, you know, I knew it was up. Now you know what happened. This woman so loved me. She said to me one time, Leslie, There is nothing you can do, including drink, that would make me not love you. I was just, really? You know, I sort of gave her a lot of different, you know, examples of past bad behavior. And she said, no. She said, now, I don't profess to like you all the time, but I always love you. And I am always in your corner, and I will always want the best for you. I've never heard anyone but my mother, who probably had a couple of strings attached and an agenda, I'm sure, attached to that, although my mother's such a sweet old lady. But that's the way she was. She was so solid in how she felt about Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracle of recovery and a God working in her life that she saw fit to scrape this, I don't know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralized woman off the ground and cart her around in her pocket. And she started me, of course, working steps, which is how she had recovered, and she brought the we of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And together we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And she shared her powerlessness with me, and she shared the unmanageability of her life with me, and she talked about getting a new manager, and she talked about accepting the powerlessness of my condition. And she didn't look like she was doing too badly, and I related to her sense of powerlessness, and I found my own in that we that we were experiencing. And when we moved to step two, you know, I confessed to her that it wasn't that I did not believe in God. It was what I believed about God. That was really a problem for me, and had been a problem for me. I just knew that with my bad behavior of the past, and the shame and the remorse and guilt that I lived with on a daily basis, that I was going to have to be precious and darling for a long time before, you know, I could sort of stand in front of the Maker with any kind of, like, expectation of attention. And I don't do precious and darling for any length of time, you know, without a lot of effort still to this day. In fact, I was telling a friend that I had been up in Ukiah recently doing a barbecue speaker meeting, and it was like 4 or 5 hours long, and I said, by the time I got through speaking, I was so tired because I had been so precious and darling for so many hours that I just, you know, I had to run right home to the hotel and flop because I was just so tired. And she said, I know, this precious and darling is hard for you. And I said, it is. No, but so I just expected that in that time, I was going to have to be good for a long time, and I don't do good well. I just don't. I don't behave well. And so my sponsor talked to me about the insanity of what we believe, the insanity of doing the same thing and expecting different results, the insanity of not believing the miracle that you people are every day. She said, but do you think you're different? Do you think you've done things that other people haven't done in the room? Find something you've done that someone in the room hasn't done, and then we'll talk. And I thought, wow, really? Okay. She talked about how her higher power granted her grace even when she didn't deserve it, even when she didn't earn it, even when she wasn't conscious of the need. And I just really wanted that. I needed grace. I was so bent over with the burden of my life that at 28 years old, I was an old woman. Truly, I was done. I was dead. I was reading a Member's Eye View a few minutes ago, and he talked about how rigor mortis had set into our lives. And that's how I felt, like it was over. We moved on, and she talked to me about becoming willing to do whatever it took to move forward, and to trusting that a new manager could step in and do a better job. Like, you know, the evidence of my particular management wasn't enough for me. I had to go, well, I don't know, you know. And she talked about, you know, coming to believe and making a decision. And she talked about the fact that making a decision was just a decision, but that if you made a decision to turn right and you didn't actually take a right turn, you were going to keep going straight. And for her, the right turn was to really get a sober life. And she was quite amazing. And so so from then on for a while, I practiced step 3.5. For those of you who are not yet familiar with step 3.5, 3.5 is I am working 4. And I was working 4 for a long time. Of course, the idea of really getting pen to paper had never occurred to me. But I was, you know, I was getting ready to actually do the writing. And one day she said in front of hundreds of people, maybe 2, she said, Leslie, why don't you go home and put the rest of us out of your misery? Went right home and worked step 4. I was so embarrassed. How could she possibly do that to me? And the minute I worked 4, I absolutely had to work 5. You know, having all of that down on paper was almost, for me, more than I could stand. I actually had hidden so much and, you know, sort of, well, why did you drink? There it was. You know, right there. Why were you uncomfortable in the world? There it was. Why was the world uncomfortable with you? There it was. And so I called her up and I said, I absolutely have to do step 5 right this minute. Being, of course, concerned about her life and what she was doing. And she was so kind to me. She said, I can understand that. Why don't you come over? I don't know what she was doing, what she had to postpone in her life, what she had to stop, but she just knew that I needed to unburden. See, I never realized the burden of my life that I carried. Like, I just couldn't even stand up straight any longer. I was like doubled over like an old lady. So, of course, I wasn't driving back to that. And so I was very frightened in taking the walk, because she had forbidden me to hitchhike, taking the walk to her house to that this fourth step was going, well, what if I were killed or injured, would end up in the wrong hands and maybe end up on the front page of the newspaper, God knows. And so I put it in an envelope, sealed it up, and wrote on the front, to be destroyed if I am injured or killed. Like anyone would care. But it was important to me, okay? Important to me. And the book says that solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. And it goes on to talk about the fact that we don't really even look at our stuff correctly. That, you know, we sort of minimize our things. That was not my experience. In fact, the concept of solitary self-appraisal being insufficient with me was the fact that I had beaten myself up in this fourth step so badly that my sponsor really needed to share that moral inventory concept with me, that it wasn't a way to pursue a melancholy activity. It wasn't a way to wallow in my in my shame. It was a way to really look at what was working and what wasn't in my life. And she really brought me right back to that practice, if you will, by her steadfast sharing of her stuff. And we shared our stuff that day together. And I'll tell you something, she was sort of yawning with mine. I was most amazed with hers. Wow, this one had really been around. And the book says that sometimes, you know, this is the first time we experience the true presence of God. And that was true for me. I walked away from that experience of sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked away from that a total and completely different human being. Not to say that I don't make mistakes, not to say that I don't do bad things, not to say that, you know, I don't honestly, you know, practice these principles in all my affairs 100% of the time, but I am conscious that today there is a choice. And before that, there was no choice for me at all. She asked me to go home and do, you know, the one-hour drill and sit and look at the first five proposals and make sure that I hadn't forgotten anything and make sure that I hadn't missed anything and make sure that I hadn't shirked my responsibility in any of these areas. And I did that. And she talked to me about step six being an opportunity for God to inspire me to want to be different. See, things all of a sudden that had never meant anything to me, honesty, commitment, being reliable, having a reputation that actually mattered based on my performance and my way in the world, thinking of others were important to me. These things I had never considered to be of value ever. And I began to look day by day, incident by incident, at a way that I could put this inspiration into practice. Now, I firmly believe, and I have seen a ton in the world as well as in here, people trying to change. You know, I don't care whether it's dieting or whether it's, you know, giving up drugs or whether it's, you know, learning not to to sort of slide through a red light or a stop sign. It doesn't matter. Change is really hard. It's really hard. But that step seven allows it to be easier. You know, when I allowed God as part of the process of that inspiration, I absolutely want that change. When I am willing to let go to God inspiring me and helping me move in a different direction, I am inspired and I want the different direction. It's not something I begrudgingly go for or say, well, you know, to keep my sobriety, I guess I gotta pay the IRS, which is, believe me, the first half of my sobriety was part of that noise. You know, I kept saying to my sponsor, so why does the IRS end up on my doorstep every time? She said, well, Leslie, if you don't work 6, 7, 8, 9 with something, it's probably going to still be on your doorstep. And I thought, you mean I have to actually pay them? She said, she's only got 18 years, you know? She'll be inspired. Well, I've been inspired, okay? And consequently, the IRS did not end up on the last doorstep I have. Although I thought about it, I have to tell you, I didn't think about it. But at any rate, the things that started to inspire me, honesty, commitment, love, being tolerant, caring for others, carrying the message, being of service, all became important. And all became important at times when I could actually, you know, make those changes and when God could be part of that equation. And by the time I got to step eight, I really wanted to start the process of cleaning up my life. I wanted, my sponsor talked to me about the fact that step eight, which is make a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all, was not about saying I was sorry. Do you know how many times I said I was sorry between 0 and 28 years? Thousands. When I said I was sorry, people said, sorry, didn't do it. I mean, it just got to the point where people went, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it was so much a part of my, you know, just spiel. My sponsor talked to me about the fact that making amends was actually repairing the rips and tears in the fabric of my life. Actually going back and amending or making different situations. And I had, there was not to buy them. It was a gritty experience. I'm serious. I never thought one thing about anyone else except myself ever. And I wanted to make it different. I had some that were really frightening. I had some I didn't really want to do. And my sponsor just sat me down and we prepped every single one and I went and did them. And the amazing thing was I thought people would throw me out. People didn't. Most of the people that I went to make amends were so pleased I was doing something else with my life, were so supportive of my effort to be different, my inclusion of God in my life, that they were really supportive. They were really on board. I walked away from those experiences knowing there had to be a God, knowing that these people had been so angry before that they had literally called the police. I had ended up in jail behind half of this stuff. And yet, you know, here people were just looking at me and saying, you know what, Leslie, that's really great. And when I said things like, is there something I can do? They said, stay sober. They were thinking about me. They weren't thinking about themselves. That was it. My sponsor talked to me about staying, you know, clean, learning from my mistakes, that life is about learning, and about learning to incorporate God more and more into my life. And she talked to me about the practice of daily inventory, the practice of communicating with a power greater than myself so that I would know what was God's will and that I would be able to plug into the power to carry out God's will, even though I was frightened, even though I was scared, even though it was a concept that I had never considered before. My sponsor got me working that carry the message step in step 12 right away. In fact, I was about 3 weeks, 3 weeks with her, which would have made me about 9 weeks sober, when she called me up in the middle of the night and she said, we're going on a 12-step call. I'll meet you on the curb in 15 minutes. Well, I hadn't gone anywhere in 15 minutes in years. I said, 15 minutes? She said, you don't have to look gorgeous. They're not going to notice. I went outside and she said, go back and get your big book. She said, you may hold the big book, smile, and try to look sober. I will do the talking. And she did it. I got really good at smiling and trying to look sober. But I watched her and, you know, it just was sort of by osmosis. And as a result of having this incredible spiritual awakening, I was really able to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered and to begin to practice the principles in my affairs that I'm conscious of. And the women I sponsor have kept me sober and kept me on the beam, because I feel like I can't say to do something I'm not doing myself. And, you know, they're always, you know, sort of on me. We didn't see you at the meeting last night. Did you take the night off? I was really tired. Mm-hmm. Really, I didn't sleep much the night before. Mm-hmm. It won't happen again, I promise. They mostly sponsor me. I've had the same sponsor for 23 years, which I said to her one day, I said, you know, no one but the woman who bore me has been with me more than 23 years. She said, what makes you think I haven't bore you? I said, yeah, well, you could have a point there. And she's always there, always in my corner. In fact, I got a message from her today that she was going to be in my pocket tonight. And I hope she knows I'm in her pocket too tonight. Because the relationship between a sponsor and a sponsee for me is God-given. It's a miracle that we can survive each other at all. you know. And to take direction, oof, not a good thing for my part. Okay, and when she says, this is what you'll do, she doesn't mean this is what you might think about it. She says, this is why I think we should do some writing. That's, you go home and write. That's not, you know, think about writing and get back to me about whether you think you want to write or not. So I'm not a person that takes direction well, but I'm practicing that. My mother, who I told you before was very much a piranha, very mean, cruel woman all my life. And I guess I was about 12 years sober, and I worked steps around her. I worked steps, and she became a nice little old lady. I don't know what happened, but I now live with her. Now, if that doesn't bring terror to most of you, I don't know what will. And we don't kill each other, and we like each other, and we have a good time together. I don't know how that happened. Don't ask me, because we used to not be in. My father would walk into the room, and he would say, "There's going to be a fight. Why don't you guys go to different rooms?" And we'd say, "No, there's not going to be a fight." And 15 minutes later, we would be screaming at one another. And that's how we lived our whole lives. Until I worked steps. My sponsor said to me, "Just agree with everything she says." "What?" I said, "No, I'm not going to agree." She said, "Just agree with everything she said." And I started to agree with everything she said. And she wasn't saying things that were untrue. You know, I was amazed. Anyway, that's another story. People trust me with millions of dollars of money. With millions of dollars. They do not know my background, by the way, and I don't share that with them. Feel that's best left between God and I in that room. But they actually trust me, and you know what? I am trustworthy. I am trustworthy with other people's husbands. I am trustworthy with other people's money and their belongings and their time and their effort. I am amazed. And I'm going to close by telling you, this is something that's still, I'm a little breathless still. In July, I got to celebrate 25 years. 25 years. How did that happen? The women I sponsor said, "We're going to give you a big party." I said, "No, I don't think so." They said, "No, this is not up for discussion. We're just telling you because we know you don't like surprise parties. We're doing you a favor here." And by the time the party came, I was so excited. I was, you know, I could hardly sleep the night before. And I was telling everyone, "Have you heard? I'm having a party. I'm 25 on Saturdays. Have you heard?" And the whole fellows were going, "We've heard. We'll be there. We've heard. Thanks, Les." I was just, everyone was so grateful it was over. And my mother, who really hasn't shared much of my sobriety with me, you know, I would say to her, "Do you want to come and see me get my 10-year chip?" She'd say, "Oh, honey, it's really not my kind of thing, you know." "No, Mom, it's not your kind of thing." She was there for the party, for the chip, for the whole bit, and just loving it, just loving it. Which just goes to show you that just don't drink, work steps, get a God in your life, get a big book, read it, get a sponsor, and the most miraculous things will happen. I want to end tonight by reading for the new people a couple of paragraphs from the big book. It's on page 152, which is in a vision for you. And it's how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous and how many of us feel. It says, "We have shown how we got out from under. You say, 'Yes, I am willing,' but am I consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum? May I say lame as well? Like some righteous people I see. I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you." Thank you, everybody, for having me.